Well, thank you for that introduction, Ramesh. I'm part Chinese, but I can tell you, although I grew up in Sydney, I was never mistaken for Indian. Can I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past and present. Today I'd like to talk to you about racism, how we should respond to it. In modern Australia, there has emerged, if you like, a distinctive genre of racism. I think you all know what I mean. Picture an incident of racial abuse or harassment on a train or a bus. Picture a YouTube clip of fuzzy images of someone dishing out abuse to another person. Think of Adam Goods at the MCG last year, or of Jeremy Fernandez on a bus not long ago, or a French-speaking woman on a bus in Melbourne in late 2012. We all know what it looks like. We all know how ugly it is. But yet there are some people who say that racism is something that can be exaggerated in terms of its harms and its effects. Some will say sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Some will say that we don't need laws that are addressed to the evil of racism. That if there is a problem with race, people should just simply speak back and leave it at that. And as Ramesh alluded to in his introduction, there are some who would say that the price of free speech in a liberal democracy may well be that you have to accept that at times you might be offended, insulted, or humiliated on the basis of race. Tough luck. Well, today I'd like to make the case on why we shouldn't be complacent about racism and why it's important for us to take a strong stand at all levels of society. Yes, through our everyday behaviour, yes, through our organisations, but also through our laws, that we need to be unequivocal and emphatic in the message that we send about racial tolerance. Specifically, what I'd like to do is I'd like to talk a little about what racism means today, because it is a term of dispute. Some people understand it to mean one thing, others understand it to mean another. So I'll go through what I would consider to be the main dimensions of racism. Then I'll talk about the harms of racism and what the evidence tells us about what racism does to those who are on the receiving end. I'll talk then about a particular problem I see as a special challenge for us today, cyber racism and cyber bullying, and how this has presented us with I think, a very peculiar task now. And then I want to conclude by talking about leadership and the importance of setting a tone, and about the work that we're doing at the Australian Human Rights Commission about combating racism through our Racism It Stops With Me public awareness campaign. But let's start with what racism means. If you were to turn to your dictionaries, you may well get something like this: a belief about the racial superiority of one or some groups over others. A doctrine. I think this is a very narrow definition of racism, because racism, as we understand it today, means many more things. It means much more than the 19th century doctrine of the white man's burden. Here I've got an example of a quote from one commentator from the 1860s who spoke about the impossibility of a Negro ever equaling the standard Caucasian in natural ability. But today we see racism in different ways. You don't need to sign up to a doctrine of racial superiority in order to do something that's racist in nature. Here's a sign that was put up by a publican in Coolgardie in Western Australia earlier this year: no Indigenous person will be served in this hotel until my Apple iPhone is returned that was stolen on Saturday. I think that counts as a form of racism or racial discrimination. Clearly doesn't involve any notion of superiority, but nonetheless, there's discrimination there. You may be familiar with the face of this man, Donald Sterling, owner of the LA Clippers basketball team in the NBA. I see you nodding, so you're familiar. But he had a conversation with his then-girlfriend that was leaked, in which he said to her, "You should not be bringing black people to my basketball matches." Interesting to note, the coach of the LA Clippers happens to be an African American. Many of the players in that team happen to be African American, as is the case in many of the NBA teams. I think what you have here is another instance of something that resembles what we would consider racism, even if it may not involve a blanket form of discrimination. I mean, if Donald Sterling was a truly committed racist, for want of a better word, then maybe he'd ban people who were African American from playing for his teams, but he didn't do that. Another example, here's a picture of a frat party, undisclosed, but you have there students who've dressed up in Ku Klux Klan robes or who've blackfaced themselves. I think many of us may also recall at this and think that there's something racist at play here. But is there something about racial superiority necessarily? Maybe, maybe not. I think the response many of you might offer is to say, well, this is a bit different from the other cases, because maybe here you've got people who are just joking around. Maybe they didn't intend to do anything that was offensive. They're just having a bit of fun. And I think that sheds light on another characteristic of racism as well, which I'll come to a bit later, which is that intention, malicious intention, or doctrinal commitment need not always be part of the racist equation. As we see in this case as well, a lot of debate about whether Jonah from Tonga may have some undertones or overtones of prejudice and discrimination. I think it's a fascinating debate to follow where one falls on that. I've got here some pictures of African-American students at Harvard University who've put up on their whiteboards their comments that have been directed at them. You may not be able to make it out on the left. You don't sound black. You sound smart. On the right, you're lucky to be black. So easy to get into college. I think, again, what we're seeing here is perhaps not an overt act of discrimination, but something about attitudes and prejudice and judgment, perhaps. I present to you all of these slides to illustrate what I consider to be the many dimensions of racism. Yes, historically we know that racism has been bound up with doctrines of racial superiority. In the 19th century, it was very common for people to be measuring the size of skulls, to be talking about phrenology, to be referring to race and superiority in scientific terms or quasi-scientific terms. That's not so common these days. Today, racism is about stereotypes, negative stereotypes that are rehearsed about groups based on characteristics associated with race and ethnicity. It's about prejudice, about assuming, as we saw in those pictures of those Harvard students, that because you are of background X or Y, you couldn't possibly be A or B. It's also about discrimination, as we saw most starkly in that slide involving the publican in Coolgardie, who said that no Indigenous person will be served. And the sources of racism also highlight to us just how complex it is. Quite often people will say, well, racism is born of hate. And it is. Or that racism is born of fear. And it can be. I think that racism can also be born of other things as well. It can be the product of ignorance, of someone not knowing better. It can also be the product of arrogance, of people thinking that they already know everything that needs to be known. But at the end of the day, racism is about something that negatively impacts on another person based on their race or ethnicity. That's a very basic definition that I think we can all agree on. So to what extent does racism exist today in Australia? I'm a champion of multiculturalism in our country. I think in the decades since post-war migration began following the Second World War, we've come leaps and bounds from a country where 90% or more would have been Anglo or Celtic in ethnicity in 1945, 46. We're now a country where one in five people speak a language other than English at home. 25%, actually it's about 28% now, of people were born overseas. Another 20% have a parent who was born overseas. So close to half of our population is either first generation or second generation Australian. But nonetheless, racism happens. And about 20% of Australians say according to research done by the University of Western Sydney, that they've experienced verbal racial abuse. About 11% say that they have been excluded from the workplace or social settings because of their race. And perhaps most troubling of all, about 5% of people say they've been physically assaulted on racial grounds. If you consider the size of our population, 23 million, and think about what 5% means, that's quite a lot. Other evidence suggests that racism may be on the rise. So the Scanlon Foundation, which conducts an annual survey into social cohesion, found last year that 19% of people say they've experienced racial or religious discrimination of some kind. In 2012, this was at 12%. So since this study has been running since 2007, the levels have been roughly at 10 or 12%. What we're seeing is something different, something out of the ordinary. What we're seeing as well is that there are some groups of Australians who are particularly susceptible to experiencing racial or religious discrimination. Those from Asian countries of origin, the figures from the Scanlon Foundation suggest that about 40% or so from people from China, Malaysia, and the subcontinent say that they've experienced racial or religious discrimination. There was a study done recently in Victoria concerning Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians, which found that figure to be dramatically higher. So about 90+% of people say that they've experienced racial discrimination of some kind. And I think that is an indication of how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians experience racism in the most systemic way imaginable. And when it comes to children and young people, we are seeing some very disturbing signs as well. A recent study found that among those of non-Anglo ethnic and cultural backgrounds, 80% say that they've experienced racial discrimination. You'd think that the school would be a safe environment for our children and young people, but unfortunately, over 2/3 of these experiences in this survey happened at school. So the schoolyard and the classroom is not immune from abuse and harassment. What then are the harms of racism? Is it just about hurt feelings? Is it about injured sensibilities? Or is it about something more? I think there's a very civic harm to racism, which is to say that discrimination and prejudice is an offence to our notion of citizenship, the value that everyone in our society should be treated equally and as a member of society with equal dignity. When racism happens, it can have a very devastating effect on community cohesion and on how people can relate or identify with Australia as a society. There are also physiological and mental health consequences of racism too that have been well established in research conducted by psychologists and those in the medical field. Those among you who have experienced an incident of racism before will probably relate to this, but it can have a very visceral feel. Your heart rate goes up, you can start sweating, you can get tense, you can find it difficult to sleep at night after an incident. We know too that depression, anxiety, psychosis are raw symptoms of repeated exposure to racial discrimination. I think the human dimension of racism is something that we don't always recognise, particularly if one has never experienced racism firsthand or seen its effects up close. Here are some responses to a consultation that the Human Rights Commission conducted a few years ago, where we asked people to tell us about what the experience of racism felt like. I experience racism on an all too regular basis. It's a tremendous psychological blow because it's something that I experienced from age 5. It leaves me feeling helpless and vulnerable for days afterwards. Or the quote at the bottom, it makes me feel like I'm lower than everyone else, an intruder who is not part of this society. Don't know about you, but I think the harms go way beyond hurt feelings. Let me turn to cyberbullying, which I mentioned earlier as a particular challenge that has emerged in recent times. Is it the same thing as just plain bullying? This is a question that often gets asked. And I think at one level, you're talking about an identical phenomenon. In that you're talking about someone who wants to wield power over another person, and someone who is willing and often able to insult, degrade, humiliate, belittle another person because they can, or because it makes them feel stronger. That's the basic feeling or impulse when it comes to bullying. But when bullying happens online or through electronic forms, I think there are some distinctive qualities to it. It's distinctive because it can be invasive. It can be invasive in the sense that you may go home, turn on your computer in the privacy of your bedroom or your living room, and be subjected to cyberbullying. The audience is also different. Whereas in physical bullying, you have someone there poking you in the chest, one-on-one, face-to-face, the audience here is different. It's not confined to a room or to a public space. If you're being humiliated on the internet, the audience can be millions or billions. There's the anonymity of cyberbullying as well. If someone is insulting you to your face, you know who's saying it. But quite often, as the experience of young people in cyberbullying reveals, bullying is done under the cloak of anonymity. Now, research into this area is still fairly recent and new, but it suggests that about 1 in 10 young people experience bullying online. 1 in 10. And there's been a particular rise in the human rights experience in cyber racism. So on platforms such as social media or video sharing websites, we are seeing cyberbullying assume a racial form increasingly. But cyberbullying needn't be racist in character, of course. It can be something that is conducted on the basis of one's non-racial appearance, one's beliefs, one's lifestyle choices, and so on. Let me just show you a clip now, which I think encapsulates what the experience of cyberbullying may look like. So that was a video from our Back Me Up campaign that the Human Rights Commission launched in 2012. I think it was a very powerful illustration of just how invasive cyberbullying can be, how it can track you in different settings. But the message in that video too was just how members of one's peer group, when it concerns children and young people, can have a very powerful effect in intervening. This is what the research is suggesting to us, that the most effective way to stop cyberbullying is for a friend to stand up for another friend. and it needn't involve anything dramatic. All it may just require is just a friend to reassure another person that they can be there to be counted on. But what we did with Back Me Up, this was an initiative that was done in partnership with about 19 organisations in civil society, including mental health organisations and also young people. And we encouraged people to send in videos that they made about cyberbullying. And we received about 100 entries, one of which was the one that I just showed you. But it affirms that important need for all of us to reflect on what we can do to intervene in cases when we see antisocial behaviour. I'm just going to show you another clip which embodies that message, as you see in the top left-hand corner there, Back Me Up. Don't stand by, it could be you. So let's play this next clip as well. Here are some of the responses to young people with Back Me Up. Back Me Up has made me more confident as to what I can do as a bystander. And this has been a focus of our work at the Commission, targeting bystanders and empowering people to know what you can do. And knowing that you can take action when you see the signs of bullying taking place. And I think this goes to the kind of culture that we should be thinking about building in our organisations and also in our society more generally. Quite simply, context matters. If you have a social climate or culture where you tolerate or accept or implicitly endorse behaviour that belittles another person, then it can really open the floodgates. License is an important factor here. We all take our social cues from those around us. Often it happens in very subtle ways. Sometimes all that needs to be done is for someone to give a wink or a nudge, and that can be all that there is to it. And I think this is a reminder of just how important leadership is when it concerns antisocial behaviour, whether it's cyberbullying or whether it's racism. I want to turn now to leadership when it concerns racism. One sign of Australia's leadership as a multicultural society has been that we have been prepared to put into our laws an explicit commitment to racial tolerance and social cohesion through something like the Racial Discrimination Act, which is our federal law concerning racial discrimination. We have a very explicit statement that racial discrimination is not to be tolerated in the public life in our country. Our laws, for example, state explicitly that you cannot discriminate on race, colour, ethnic or national origin when it comes to the provision of goods and services, when it concerns employment, when it concerns housing and accommodation, or when it concerns advertising. The law has been in place since 1975. It wasn't, however, until 1995 that the law included protections against racial vilification in public places. So between 1975 and 1995, all that the law explicitly protected was people from acts of discrimination in those defined areas I noted, but if it came to racial abuse or harassment in the public place, the law actually didn't cover that. So what happened was this. In the late 1980s, there was a rising community concern about racist incidents. You had a number of major inquiries and reports, including the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, the National Inquiry into Racist Violence, which was conducted by one of my predecessors, Irene Moss, and the Law Reform Commission conducted a report into multiculturalism and the law. And the government of the day responded to these reports by introducing a provision in the Racial Discrimination Act which prohibited racial vilification. So the law, in the words of Section 18C, I can't think, by the way, of a particular section of Commonwealth legislation that has been discussed at such length in our public debate, but Section 18C makes it unlawful for there to be an act otherwise in public that's reasonably likely to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate a person or group of people on the grounds of race or ethnicity. This is accompanied by Section 18D, which states that the law is to protect artistic expression, scientific and academic inquiry, and fair reporting and fair comment on a matter of public interest, provided that it's done reasonably and in good faith. Now, these laws have been in place for about two decades. Courts have interpreted them in a uniform and consistent manner, which is to say that we're not talking about protecting people from just hurt feelings. I can't make a complaint about the Racial Discrimination Act if I merely believe that you have offended or insulted my opinion. The conduct that's prohibited is anything that offends, insults, humiliates, or intimidates on the grounds of race. That's very clear. What's also been clear in the court's determination under this law is that only profound and serious effects are covered by the law. So trivial slights, no can do. We're talking about something that harms people in a very serious and profound way. Also, what we've seen is that the free speech exemption of Section 18D has, we've seen that being interpreted by the courts in a very broad way. To give you some examples, during the political high watermark of Pauline Hanson, she was actually subject to a complaint by a person of Aboriginal background who alleged that in a book that she had written, Pauline Hanson, The Truth, Ms. Hanson had said some things about Aboriginal people which were offensive or insulting to Aboriginal people. Namely, that Aboriginal people were receiving special privileges that didn't extend to other Australians, among other things. The court in that case found that this was protected speech, that even if the person complaining had found this to be offensive and insulting on racial grounds, it was conducted in good faith as part of public debate in a liberal democracy. Now, there was another notorious case recently involving the newspaper columnist Andrew Bolt, which has been centre to the ongoing debate about racial vilification. In that case, Mr. Bolt had written a number of articles in, about fair-skinned Aboriginal Australians, and a number of them complained, alleging that he had offended, insulted, humiliated, and intimidated them on the grounds of race. The federal court in that case found that Mr. Bolt could not be found to enjoy the protection of free speech because the protection extends to behaviour that is done reasonably and in good faith. Namely, the court found that Mr. Bolt had made some errors of fact, distortions of the truth, and had used inflammatory and provocative language, and it was a combination of those factors, not just one of those factors, but a combination of those factors which meant that he could not enjoy the protection of free speech in the law because he could not be found to have acted reasonably and in good faith. I hope this gives you some, without getting into too much of the technical elements of it, but I think it's very important, some sense of how the law is operated. And I think it's important to remember that this is not the only piece of law in Australia that impinges upon what you can say in public. For example, our parliamentarians in our state and federal parliaments adhere to standing orders which require them to withdraw if they were to use offensive words or language. We have criminal summary offence laws in our states and territories, which mean that you can be convicted under the criminal law for using offensive language in a public place. Beware if you were to use the F word, by the way, in public, because that could lead to a conviction In New South Wales last year, 12,000 people were convicted for using offensive language in a public place. This law, by the way, the Racial Discrimination Act, is not a criminal law. All it means is that you go to conciliation if someone makes a complaint. You can't be prosecuted or convicted under this law, I should note. We also have defamation laws, which mean that you can pay six-figure civil damages if you were to use words that offend people's reputations. Ray Hadley of 2UE recently was found by a court to have been to have engaged in defamatory conduct. He was required by the court to pay $280,000 in damages for calling a woman silly and for calling her a grub. You have another case where a restaurant review in Fairfax Media was subject to a defamation claim, and three of those defendants was each fined $160,000 in damages for saying of a restaurant that it was a blight on the culinary landscape of Sydney. I will not name that restaurant. But my point is this: if we can accept that our elected representatives should be prevented from using offensive language in our parliament, if we can accept that the law can lead you to being convicted for using offensive language in a public place under the criminal law, if we can accept that you can pay six-figure damages under the laws of defamation, then why can't we also have laws that allow citizens to hold others accountable when they're racially abused and harassed? There are two freedoms at stake in this debate. Freedom of speech is fundamental, but there's also freedom from discrimination. And to those who say that we should celebrate a right to bigotry, I ask, what about the right to be free from the effects of bigotry? Because this is what the debate is really about. It's about the kind of society we want Australia to be. Let me turn now to non-legislative matters, because while the law is a powerful instrument for us to communicate our values when it comes to racial tolerance, and I think Australians are overwhelmingly supportive of that, Fairfax Media conducted a poll recently which found that 88% of Australians believe that it should remain unlawful to offend, insult or humiliate someone on the basis of race. The law alone cannot do the job for us. We also need to take action in non-legal forms. What we do at the Australian Human Rights Commission is we lead the National Anti-Racism Strategy. That brings together a number of government departments and civil society organisations. We've targeted a number of areas where systemic racism is a problem. Areas such as the media, government service provision, employment and the workplace, sport, youth. Among other things, we have worked on preparing curriculum material, which will be released later this year, on anti-racism, targeted at years 5 and 6 when it comes to health and physical education and also history, and also in years 9 and 10. The content of this material is really aimed at two things, empathy and action. It's important in our schools that our future citizens and members of society are taught to consider the perspective of others, to put themselves in other people's shoes. In short, to exercise empathy. But we also believe that it's important, as you will have been able to tell from our Back Me Up work, that action is fundamental, that young people need to be prepared to take action and put their values into practice as well. Our main initiative in this area when it concerns public awareness is the Racism It Stops With Me campaign. We aim through this campaign to empower people to stand up to racism and also to ensure that tools and resources are shared among organisations committed to combating racism. So far, we have more than 250 organisations in business, in sport, in civil society, in government that have joined the campaign. If your organisation is interested in joining the campaign, we'd be delighted to have you on board. We believe that grassroots action is fundamental to changing behaviour. Let me just show you a quick clip of some of the work that we're doing with Racism It Stops With Me, featuring our ambassador, Australian of the Year, Adam Goods.
racism.
Has no place in sport.
No place in sport.
Everyone.
Everyone deserves a fair go. Regardless of skin colour,
background,
or culture.
Racism!
Racism! It stops with me.
It stops with me.
It stops with me.
With me.
With me.
With me.
Racism! It stops with me.
That was last year's instalment. I'm delighted to say that on Saturday we're releasing the next instalment featuring Adam Goods. We shot the video about a week and a half ago at the MCG. We're very excited at the commission to be putting that out tomorrow morning, so keep an eye out for that. The bystander scenario is what we're really aiming at here through the public awareness campaign. It's about ensuring that people just don't stand by. There was a notorious example in New York in the 1970s, which is a classic of the literature on social psychology, involving a woman called Kitty Genovese, who was murdered in New York City street in the presence of 38 witnesses, people who heard her screaming for help. None of them did anything to help her. An extreme case like that, though, tells us that there is a very real challenge psychologically when it comes to bystander behaviour. One recent study showed that almost half of those who saw an incident of racial bullying at school did nothing. What's more troubling, though, is that a quarter of people there who are bystanders may have encouraged the bullying to continue. So what can bystanders do? We tell people through our campaign that you can do something. Even if you can't intervene in a situation physically, if it's not safe to do so, you can do something. You can report an incident to an authority or to police or to the Human Rights Commission. You can film something on your camera, as people are increasingly doing. Or you can just give comfort and support to someone who's a target of abuse and harassment too. We know that when someone in public decides to abuse another person, they in fact believe that the majority of people around them endorse and support their actions. To see someone else stand up and say, "Hold on, can you stop that? That's not okay," or "You're making a fool of yourself," is a powerful statement against that assumption. Here's what some of our supporters have done. I referred earlier to the French woman on the bus in Melbourne who was subject to racial abuse, which made the news. The bus company that ran that route, Ventura Bus Lines, joined the campaign, introduced a protocol for their bus drivers on how to respond to racist incidents, and also put up posters on all their buses, informing people what they can do when they see an act of racism. Recently, last year in Maitland, there was a very well-publicised report involving vandalism of a property owned by newly arrived African refugees. What we had was an overwhelming response from Maitland City. The City Council and the local businesses on the main strip actually came together and put up a commitment to racial tolerance in all of their shopfront windows, and we had a very strong example of a community response to racism. Let me conclude on this note. I hope that I've made clear to you that racism is a complex thing. It's not about racial superiority, but it's about prejudices, stereotypes that can lead to acts of discrimination. I hope I've made clear to you too that the harms of racism are not confined to mere hurt feelings, but go to the heart of individual dignity and freedom. Yes, you may be able to exercise your freedom, but it's not absolute freedom that we're talking about. Freedom must be accompanied by responsibility, because the exercise of one's freedom may well have the effect of diminishing another person's freedom. I hope as well that I've made clear to you that it's important that we send, as a society, the strongest possible signal in combating racism, and that includes through our laws. Some have said that, well, we don't really need laws because they don't eradicate racism. That if we've had them for 2 decades now, or 4 decades, in the case of the Act more generally, and racism still exists, why do we need it? I mean, can't we just rely on social sanctions alone to do the job? Well, I say to you this. We also have laws against murder, laws against theft. Have those laws eradicated murder and theft? And if they haven't, is that a good reason to be getting rid of them? I don't think so. But I'll end on this note, and that's a call to action to all of you. I think the responsibility is on the part of all of us to do whatever we can in our everyday lives to combat racial discrimination when it happens. And I want you to consider what you can do in talking to a family member, a friend, a colleague at work, or someone on your sporting team if you play a sport, and get them to think twice about the impact of their words and behaviour. And at the end of the day, it is that message that we promote that we'd like to get you to think about. Racism does stop with all of us, and the task of combating it starts with all of us. Thank you very much.